Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 85, titled The Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Part 1.
Of course, there's some beautiful things in the early chapters. My favorite thing of all in the conscientiousness chapter is where Shantideva says, actually, I don't remember exactly what the verse number is. But anyway, where he talks about how he won't, you know, when he sits around chatting with someone at a picnic, and he won't like mindlessly pluck blades of grass. You know, he won't like just nervously pull out blades of grass when he's sitting around. But my favorite is when someone asks him for directions, he will never point like this and say, where's Low Library? Oh, it's over there. He will never point with the index finger like that. He will use his whole hand, and he will make a gesture as you would to invite an honored guest, and he would say, Low Library is over there, with his whole hand. And then he will reflect in his mind, today you want to go to Low Library, so I am inviting you to go there. And someday you will want to go to Buddhahood, and I will invite you to go there. I love that one. I particularly like that. It's so conscious, and if you have had experience in Asian cultures, you know, with Tibetans or Chinese or Japanese or Koreans or the East Asian ones, and Indians too, they have things like where they will gesture with the hand. They will not say, come in, you know, because this is a bossy type of gesture. You know, it's like, I know you don't, get over there. You know, it has a subliminal, that gesture has a subliminal text that goes with it, the body language. But an invitational thing is you're at the service of the person requesting and you're seeking to help them fulfill their aim of get the Low Library. So you invite them there. And it's so nice, you know. And that a lot of the Vinaya, you know, and it comes out of the Vinaya, what is called the Vinaya, which we translate as the discipline. But in a way, a lot of the Vinaya, and some of them seem to be moral rules, like, you know, don't have sex or don't lie about your state of awareness or whatever it is. You know, so they're lying, killing, etc. But a lot of it is etiquette, what goes at manners and etiquette. You know, like sometimes frustrated presidents, like I could see Obama, I could really see him in his old age, all grizzled with his beard, sitting there writing a book of etiquette for senators and especially congressmen. Right? How you behave, you know, how to behave, you know, when you're supposed to be representing the nation and governing, and you're not going to shut down everything and cost everybody hundreds of billions of dollars. And so writing a book on manners. George Washington wrote a book on manners, apparently. I didn't read it, on etiquette and manners. He did. Did you know that? Did you ever read that book? I didn't either. But I've been meaning, every time I get to that point in the lecture, I then think I should do that. But I will get distracted. So a lot of the Vinaya is that. Like I told you about the 18 things about slurping. The 18 different precepts not to slurp this and that way. And then how to do gestures and things like that. So that's where that thing of Shantideva comes from. But I particularly like it. But anyway, what's most famous in Shantideva, the great achievement of Shantideva that's considered, are two things, and they are really one thing, but sort of given in two doses. The locus classicus in the text of his special precept from Manjushri, it is thought, have to do with patience and compassion. And the patience chapter is where he deals with the developing patience. I don't know about the word patience. It's the classical correct word for Western moralist writers for bearing injury without anger, you know, and avoiding becoming angry. It's the opposite of anger. Patience, opposite of anger. Angry reaction, patient reaction. But we think of patience as waiting to get something at some time, as a waiting for something. It's how it really is a connotation in English nowadays. And so I really think tolerance is a better word. And I do use that. I try to use that myself. But anyway, never mind. So why is that? Because the great thing in Satyadeva is his teaching of compassion. And there are two teachings of compassion. One of them we haven't no chalk. My goodness. What have they done? Well, anyway, one of them is considered called the sevenfold cause and effect precept. And oh, here's chalk. Sevenfold cause and effect precept. And it is of mother recognition and so forth. So one of them on compassion is called the sevenfold. Causal precepts, which are to develop universal compassion and the spirit of the Bodhisattva spirit of enlightenment, which have to do with recognizing all beings as having been your mother in previous lives and so on, and then developing gratitude and developing that through love and compassion and a kind of messianic sense of responsibility, and then developing the Bodhisattva spirit. And the second one is this one, which is called the exchange, or the equal exchange of self and other. And these are whereas this one comes through Asanga and Maitreya, Bodhisattva Maitreya, although it's in Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching, but it's highlighted. It becomes a living precept or transmission or tradition through Maitreya and Arya Asanga. And this one comes through Shantideva, a little bit via Nagarjuna from Manjushri. And that's in chapter 8 in the meditation chapter, after some horrible things to kind of get you settled. Then that's taught there. But they say before you can develop universal compassion for all beings, you have to first forgive them, kind of, and not be angry with them. So first you develop this tolerance or patience, and then there are said to be three levels of the patience. The first six verses in this one: whatever wholesome deeds, such as venerating the Buddhas and generosity that have been amassed over 1,000 aeons, will all be destroyed in one moment of anger. So this is like overcoming an addiction. The first step in overcoming an addiction is to see that the thing you're addicted to is really harmful. It's not your friend. And so that's what that first verse is about. And then he states that. He says there is no evil like hatred and no fortitude like patience or tolerance. Thus I should strive in various ways to meditate on patience. So in English, patience versus hatred, they're not natural opposites, right? Now, according to, actually in Chaucer, in moralist writings, a patience is the opposite of hatred, or anger and hatred, but not today. Tolerance, rather than hating someone to tolerate them, and then loving. So love is an opposite, and you weigh love is an opposite of hate, you could say, and tolerance is an opposite of anger, something like that, you could say. So, thus I should strive in various ways to meditate on patience, but never mind that, we're using patience. My mind will not experience peace if it fosters painful thoughts of hatred. I shall find no joy or happiness. Unable to sleep, I shall feel unsettled. So you know that when you're very angry, you go to bed angry, you're very disturbed, and your mind is filled with negative fantasies about whatever made you angry, and you're brooding, how could it be, how could this happen to me? Oh, that person, I'll get them. You know, it's all this kind of thing. It's disturbing to you yourself. It's an uncomfortable and unpleasant state of mind. And then for a master who has anger, he keeps saying hatred. It's okay, but anger is important. Anger, he doesn't really hate his servants. He's just angry sometimes. He screams at his employees and servants and so forth. He loses his cool with them. He berates them. So it's really anger is better than hatred here. He's in danger of being killed, even by those who, for their wealth and happiness, depend upon his kindness. So even though they need that person, that they resent him, although they suppress it, but then he's in danger, so it's a bad thing there. It doesn't have a good effect. Anger and hatred, anger, hatred doesn't. By it, friends and relatives are disheartened. Though drawn in by my generosity, they will not trust me. In brief, there is nobody who lives happily with anger. Hence the enemy, anger, creates suffering such as these. But whoever assiduously overcomes it finds happiness now and hereafter. So those six verses are said to sort of set the stage for the yoga of developing tolerance or patience. And then starting from seven, and then seven is kind of connected to it in that seven is a brilliant thing, actually. Seven and eight together, actually. Seven through ten, actually, let me say. Seven through ten are really, really the key of how to overcome the anger habit, actually. You know, anger management in that movie. Not like that, not taking your gun and shooting pillows. But this is the real key. Having found the fuel of mental unhappiness, which actually could be translated frustration. Actually, I have a translation of this. It might be better. I hope it is. Where is it? What does mine say? Hate finds it. Well, I'm using hate. Oh, dear. Hate finds its food in the mental discomfort I feel faced with the unwanted happening and the blocking of what I want to happen. It then explodes and overwhelms me. And he says, having found its fuel of mental unhappiness in the prevention of what I wish for and in the doing of what I do not want, hatred increases and then destroys me. I like mine better. Although maybe anger would be better than hate. Hate finds its food in the mental discomfort I feel faced with the unwanted happening and the blocking of what I want to happen and then explodes and overwhelms. Now I would translate mental discomfort as frustration. So the fuel of anger is frustration. I think I was hesitating because there is the word mind in there, being too literal. Seeing that, I should carefully eliminate that food that gives life to the enemy. For that enemy has no activity at all other than causing me harm. So that's an important one. This is very key in the very key thing. If you have a way, somebody you know, does anybody have someone they know who presses your buttons? Uncle Joe, the Republican at Thanksgiving, who starts repeating Rush Limbaugh or something, or whatever, or the opposite, if there is such a thing. So this involves using mindfulness to become aware of the chain reaction from when the button is pressed, and then there's a feeling of frustration that builds up, and then it explodes in some kind of anger, and you tell Uncle Joe, you throw your turkey leg at Uncle Joe for Thanksgiving, or you splatter him with some cranberry sauce, and then poor mom who cooked the dinner like freaks out, so ruining the dinner, and. So the key there is to become more aware, and then the thing about it is the frustration building is key. That's the fuel of the angry, explosive situation. So the key is to intervene at that point. And my wife is actually expert at it. So much so that our eldest son, who is somewhat of a wit, who is the family wit, he made a motto for her. And his motto for her is, he's not here so I can say it. Why be nice to them for a while only to have them get mad at you later when you can piss them off right away? I love that. But what that means is, that's really a compliment actually, because it means that if something that annoys you starts to happen again, you know, you've had bad scenes over in the past, or you didn't have a scene and you felt bad for some time, and you gnawed away at it for hours on end about what you should have said, and they told you this, and whatever it is. The thing to do is when at first you note, by being more mindful, you note the frustration starting to build, and then you act while you're still in a good humor. So then you say to Uncle Joe, oh, come on. Here's some Limbaugh sauce. Shut up, you know, like, you know what I mean? I'm saying that's what you know what I mean. So you know, you do something humorous, but you intervene with it. You actively and energetically, preemptively, you know, stop suppressing yourself to be polite. I think women in our culture particularly have that habit. It's like April McCloskey or whatever her name was. You know, when Saddam said to her, oh, by the way, April, that's April. I think tomorrow I have a feeling, I think I'm going to invade Kuwait. She goes, oh, really? Oh, okay, well, I'm not sure that's cool, but, you know, I'll go call up Washington. So then he runs his tanks in there, instead of freaking out right away. So be polite, you know, and then let it build, and then you get a divorce, you know, instead of interrupting the foolish behavior immediately when you're in a good humor. That's like, for example, myself. One of her favorite things, I've had a bad day at the office. Somebody has really annoyed me, and I'm like steaming and spewing. I come home, and then I come home, and then people are there, and then oh, you look a little like, well, what's the matter? And then I start to go like that, and then I'm starting to recite a big thing in a terrible mood, and then I'm told, why don't you just shut up about it before everybody else is pissed off too? And then I'm even ready to get mad, and then, oh, but it's done, delivered with humor. So then I work on internally dispelling the mood, and then sometime later might recount the story when in a good mood. And that's the kind of brilliant thing of not letting the fuel of frustration, of mental discomfort build up, of a situation that you see happening that you don't want to happen, or somebody presenting what you think should happen, those two situations. So whatever befalls me, I shall not disturb my mental joy. This is using your happiness, your bliss, your good feeling to prevent getting angry. For having been made unhappy, I shall not accomplish what I wish, and my virtues will decline. So if I get really frustrated, where I then react to a bad situation in a very angry and clumsy and annoying way, and then there's a big, then somebody says, well, maybe you're right, but I didn't like the way you said it. You know how people say that? Because you're already angry and you're saying it too harshly, and then so you're trying to rectify, but it doesn't work. So that's the thing. If you stay teary, that's key. This is the secret of the British Empire on the good side, besides all their bad racism. The good side about it is, cup of tea, stiff upper lip. Have a cup of tea, and the bombs are falling or something. That's very, very important. It's like keeping some sort of mental joy alive. And then this is the great verse, and I like my translation of it. If I'm unhappy about something, what did I say? I say, whatever happens, no. Why be unhappy about something if it cannot be fixed? If it can be fixed. If it cannot be fixed, what does being unhappy help? Well, I'm no good either, I think. I'm going to have to change that. Because the key, the power of that verse is that it's the exact same line. In other words, if something can be remedied, why be unhappy about it? If it cannot be remedied, why be unhappy about it? So in either case, why be unhappy? If it can be remedied, get about it while you're still happy. If it cannot be remedied, just be happy anyway. And don't add being unhappy about it, something you can't help, can't do anything about. Right? It's so great. I love that one. For myself, and so then... Now it's after that, then 11 sort of goes along with that about how you know, or not really. No, 11 starts a new thing. So that all that is just a deep analysis, and that 7 through 10 are really critical. They're really, really psychological cognitive therapy 101, really excellent.